This is Wellness 101, brought to you by the Institute of Natural Health, your home for common sense, science-based healthcare. Here's your host, Dr. TJ Williams.
And welcome to the show, everyone. Back again for another lovely edition of Wellness 101 here. Last week, for those of you who may be new to the show or weren't listening last week we spoke about heartburn and GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. And we spent a lot of time talking about how the current thinking of not having enough stomach acid, or having way too much stomach acid, rather, is causing the problem, when in fact it's actually probably the opposite, and how that flies in the face of what most people think until that's really truly explained to them. You were getting ready to say something, Erin. Go ahead. She jumped to the microphone like,
well,
she had something important.
Most of the time, it is the opposite. Most of the time, heartburn and GERD is caused by low stomach acid, not high stomach acid.
Correct. Did I say it backwards?
No, you said that, you know, sometimes this is what causes it.
Yeah, you're right. It is most often. And so I highly encourage you, we're not going to spend a lot of time going back and rehashing part one. Basically, the gist of it was that a lot of people think that heartburn and GERD is due to an acid overproduction by the stomach, when in fact, research tells us that as we age, acid production goes down, so we should have less, or we're going to have less acid in our stomach. And as we age, more people complain of heartburn. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense that acid production's going down and heartburn is going up. And then the answer to it by modern thinking and modern medicine is that it's an acid overproduction, when we know it's not.
Right. And so we covered a lot of that in the last show, and we've got so much more to get through in this show. We're going to talk about how low stomach acid causes bacterial overgrowth, how heartburn and GERD can lead to excess gas and IBS, and then how your antacid is making you sick and what you can do to correct the problem.
Ooh, it's so exciting. It's a map and an outline, ladies and gentlemen.
A lot to get through today.
So, starting off with low stomach acid causes bacterial overgrowth. All right, so one of the biggest roles of stomach acid is to stop bacterial overgrowth. When the stomach has a pH of 3 or less, which is normal, we want it to be below 3. I typically tell most of my patients that we need to keep it sticking around down around 2. Most of the bacteria that you would consume, they can't survive for more than 15 minutes. And this is also part of the reason why when we eat food, it stays in our stomach for about an hour, maybe even up to 90 minutes before it moves into the small intestine through digestion. It's there sitting in this acid bath to break down and kill all this bacteria. This is the important part, is we have to have that pH, that acid level, really, really low. So when stomach acid is not enough, or is insufficient rather, the pH of the stomach can get above 5, bacteria will actually thrive and actually even reproduce themselves. And so research with mice, they have these things, we talked a little bit about this before, how mice can have these genes where they're knocked out, and they call them knockout mice. And they can have very specific knockout mice, and one of them where they have gastrin knockout mice. Gastrin is a hormone that's made by some cells in your stomach. When in gastrin knockout mice, they're not really able to produce stomach acid. They suffer from bacterial overgrowth, and they also have inflammation, damage in their entire digestive system. They end up with precancerous polyps in their intestines. So this just goes to show that when we don't have enough stomach acid, we can have this bacterial overgrowth. And it's also pretty well documented that acid-producing drugs promote this bacterial overgrowth. Long-term use of Prilosec, which is one of the most potent acid-suppressing drugs, actually reduces the secretion of hydrochloric acid in the stomach to almost zero. And in one of the trials, they had people that had GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. They were treated with high dose of Prilosec, which is 40 grams 40 milligrams per day for at least 3 months. 11 of the 30 people treated had developed significant bacterial overgrowth. I mean, that's a third of the people, compared with only 1 in 10 in the control group. So we got 30% getting this versus 10%. I mean, that's pretty astonishing, right? And so when we don't have enough stomach acid, we actually don't digest and break down our carbohydrates. So the stomach acid supports digestion absorption of carbohydrates because it stimulates our body to release pancreatic enzymes into the small intestine. So when our food moves from our stomach into our small intestine, our pancreas will be stimulated to secrete its enzymes to help us break down carbohydrates. And if the pH of the stomach is too high, because we don't have enough stomach acid, the pancreatic enzymes won't be secreted and the carbohydrates won't be broken down properly.
Right. And this really matters because so many people out there are eating high carbohydrate diets. And so on top of the fact that you don't have enough stomach acid and are experiencing heartburn, you're taking in an acid, which lowers your stomach acid even more. And then you're eating a lot of carbohydrates, and it's making it impossible for your body to actually digest these foods and get the nutrients that you need.
Right. And what's interesting is when we have a bacterial overgrowth because we don't have the stomach acid, then we add not being able to digest those carbohydrates because the stomach acids aren't triggering the pancreatic enzymes to finish breaking down the carbohydrates. When you have those two added together, you end up with gas. And there are a lot of people, a lot of my patients come to the clinic, and one of their big complaints is gas. And they don't ever really talk about it. They just quietly mark it on the intake form, and it's never even comes up as a concern,
right,
until
not
I actually
really,
ask them.
Right. Not something they want to bring up and talk about,
right,
but when you start asking, it's something that a lot of them are experiencing.
Right. So a gentleman by the name of Robillard, and I think we talked about Dr. Robillard in the last segment. If we didn't, I meant to. He wrote a book called Heartburn Cured, and he points out that microbes are able to metabolize proteins and fats, but their preferred source of energy is actually carbohydrates. And the fermentation of carbohydrates that haven't been digested properly produces gas. So if our stomach's not producing enough acid, we're not creating the pancreatic juices, we're not breaking down those carbohydrates, they produce gas. And the resulting gas increases our intra-abdominal pressure, which is a big driving force behind gastroesophageal reflux disease and heartburn. I mean, this is straight from his book, Heartburn Cured. And this isn't rocket science, ladies and gentlemen. This is just physiology. This is what goes on. So according to these people, Suarez and Levitt, 30 grams of carbohydrates that don't get absorbed in a day.
And that's just 30 grams.
Just 30 grams.
Yes.
Just 30 grams. That's 5 teaspoons of sugar, or 6 maybe. That's not a lot. Can produce 10,000 milliliters or 10 liters of hydrogen gas. Now, this is that hot type of gas that really makes you have stomach cramps and pain and burning, and oftentimes produces pretty foul-smelling gas.
And that's a lot of gas. That's a huge amount of gas with just a small amount of carbohydrates.
That's exactly right. Think about your average water bottle that most people think about when you just think about, oh, I went to the store and I bought a water bottle. Those are 500 milliliters. That's a half a liter. You would have 40 of those full of air.
Yeah, in your stomach.
In your stomach, being produced every day. That's a lot of tooting right there. That's what that is. That's a lot. And so that's a big problem. I mean, you'll see this. I mean, think about back when those of you who have kids, think about when you had kids and you first started introducing solid foods into their diet. A lot of times the first food that's introduced is rice. It's oftentimes what doctors tell people to take. Well, that's a carbohydrate. And you introduce that too early into a little baby, that then their stomach acid isn't there and they're not able to break this stuff down. What do? They get stomach aches. They get cramps. They cry, and they get gas. They get crazy amounts of gas. And most of you out there are shaking your head because you remember, oh, yeah, I knew somebody that did that. Or, you know what? My kid had that problem. It's just something that happens. So Dr. Robillard is arguing another argument that he makes is that if gas is produced by microbial fermentation of carbohydrates, causes acid reflux, we might expect that the reflux could be treated by either A, reducing bacterial overgrowth, or B, reducing carbohydrate intake. And he points to some studies that talk about this. One study, they used an antibiotic called erythromycin, and they found that it significantly decreased esophageal reflux. Now, think about that. An antibiotic decreasing esophageal reflux. That points right to the fact that maybe we're killing off some microbes. Maybe we have some bacterial overgrowth that is responsible for this heartburn and GERD that people have. And then in another study, they found that erythromycin strengthened the lower esophageal sphincter in patients that had esophageal reflux. Now, let's go back. We talked about the lower esophageal sphincter in the last episode, in episode one. That's the little muscle that surrounds the esophagus and is between the esophagus and the stomach. And that's the thing that kind of becomes dysfunctional and causes us to have this acid from our stomach go back up into our esophagus and burn our esophagus and create this heartburn. And as far as I know, there's only been a couple of trials that test both the effects of carbohydrate restriction on GERD, and both of them had positive results.
So are you saying that people should be taking antibiotics to cure their heartburn?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's very interesting that antibiotics did cure heartburn. That just leads to the theory that Dr. Robillard has that bacterial overgrowth, because bacteria are killed by antibiotics, that's a bacterial overgrowth, can cause GERD. That's what I'm talking about. So we've got more about this when we come back. We've got to take a quick break. You're listening to Wellness 101. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. In the first segment, we were talking about how low stomach acid can cause bacterial overgrowth. And so basically, just to summarize here, low stomach acid can contribute to bacterial overgrowth, which can lead to carbohydrate malabsorption. And that has to due to the fact that we have decreased pancreatic enzyme secretion. So there are a lot of contributing factors to this, but one of the big things that we're seeing in research is that this bacterial overgrowth can be very problematic for people that are having heartburn or GERD, okay? So Dr. Robillard pointed out that the malabsorption of carbohydrates basically causes a intra-abdominal pressure increase, which causes the food in your stomach to be forced back up into your esophagus, which gives you the sensation of heartburn and can lead to GERD, okay? So by reducing the bacterial load and limiting carbohydrate intake, you can actually lower the problem and greatly improve or even sometimes cure, depending on the level of severity that you have, the acid reflux that you have going on and the GERD that you may be experiencing. Does that make sense? Everyone following, I hope, out there in listener land. There is a connection that has been seen between GERD and IBS.
Before we go on to that,
okay.
So I know I had mentioned this before. So if someone comes in with heartburn, do you treat them with antibiotics?
Once in a while, yeah. Sometimes we actually do some testing that can actually show if someone has an excess in bacteria, some potentially pathogenic bacteria, and the test kits that we actually use they actually test against antibiotics, and so it can tell us this antibiotic will kill this bacterial overgrowth that you have going on, and so we know exactly what should be prescribed to someone, and yes, we will do that.
And I think that's really one of the benefits of the Institute of Natural Health is that while you certainly aren't promoting prescription medication and definitely not prolonged use. Because there is the ability to prescribe, there are some things like heartburn that you can cure much quicker than if someone goes to a practitioner who does not prescribe medication.
Right.
As long as it's used intelligently and sparingly, I mean, modern medicine can be great. And so, you know, you could have someone who's suffering for years trying to get rid of their heartburn when, if they had just been prescribed, you know, the correct antibiotic, it could be cleared up much quicker.
Right, right. And yeah, that's the whole thing is, and we oftentimes we'll leave it up to our patients and we'll say, look, we have a couple of options here. We can do this naturally. And the likelihood is it's going to take a long time. It's going to be a slow process. This stuff doesn't fix itself overnight. It didn't become a problem overnight. It's not going to be resolved overnight. But we also have this other option where it's like a nuclear assault. We can go in there, we can kill this stuff. We know that in 7 to 10 days, it's going to be dead. And we're going to have to then rebuild the system. But rebuilding a system that's not producing a lot of excess gas can be, and is a lot less uncomfortable, can be a lot easier for a patient to handle,
right?
In all honesty.
And I understand that some people only want to go the natural route, and that's completely a personal decision.
Yeah, we don't judge. Yeah. We let them. That's perfectly fine.
I mean, I am usually, you know, wanting to do what's natural, but I also want to do what works. And I know you've said you've seen a lot of patients that have come in from other practitioners who have been trying to get rid of heartburn for years, and they keep being told, just stay with it, just stay with it. And who wants to live that way for years, waiting for it to clear up when, if they had simply been able to prescribe an antibiotic,
It would have been over in a week or so.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the whole thing.
And I think that's where people sometimes get frustrated with natural care practitioners.
Because it is a slower process.
Right.
So back to the connection between GERD and IBS. So there are a couple of guys that performed a study basically looking at the prevalence of GERD in patients with IBS. I could pronounce their names, but I would butcher it. I'll try. Malexide and Moghadam. I'm not really sure.
That sounds accurate. I'm sure that's right.
I'm pretty close. I'm pretty sure I made their moms proud with that. So if that's your last name out there, I apologize.
How would they know?
Yeah, they wouldn't know. They're like, well, that might be my name. I'm not really sure. So basically, they did this study. It had 6,500 patients, and I think it's the largest test or data set that we've seen looking at the overlap between GERD and IBS, okay? And they found that 64% of IBS patients studied also had GERD, whereas 34% of the GERD patients had IBS. So people with IBS have GERD. People with GERD, some of them have IBS. So they found that the prevalence of all functional symptoms, things like nausea, changes in bowel movements, headaches, things like that, was higher overlapping GERD and IBS than the prevalence of GERD in people without IBS or IBS subjects without GERD. I hope you were taking notes to go back and decipher that, because they're looking both directions.
So, wait, okay. I mean, so this suggests that IBS and GERD may share a common etiology?
Exactly. That's exactly what they're saying. And they're also saying at the same time that people with IBS, more people with IBS have GERD than people with GERD have IBS.
Why do we care?
Well, we care because it's important, Aaron.
Well, I mean, are you just saying that if you have IBS, you know, that it is connected? So, because I know that we've talked about, you know, people who have GERD may not have IBS yet, but just know that if you have GERD, you're at higher risk for developing IBS. And if you have IBS, you're at higher risk for...
Yeah, basically, that's what they're saying. Really, how this ties back, it goes back to our bacterial overgrowth thing. The authors of the study basically speculate that the underlying cause and the reason for this is an overgrowth of bacteria, and they're specifically mentioning H. pylori, Helicobacter pylori, as a possible culprit. They very well could be, you know, in the right vicinity for this. you know, looking deeper into that and assessing the role of H. pylori is, I think, very important for future research. It's not something that I'm going to do, but it's something that I'm definitely going to keep up with and stay abreast of. H. pylori, a lot of patients come in knowing about H. pylori. There's a lot of information out there on it. I don't know that it's the single sole culprit, but it's definitely an important one. And I just wanted to bring out that there's a study of 6,500 people that's the authors eventually suggested that a bacterial overgrowth is creating these problems in both GERD and people with IBS. It's really what the whole thing was about.
And so that is oftentimes caused by low stomach acid, correct?
Yes, correct. So, because if you have adequate levels of stomach acid, those types of bacteria, especially H. pylori, they don't survive.
So let's jump into how your antacid drug is making you sick.
Okay. So basically, stomach acid isn't there to give you a hard time for eating spicy food. That's not what it's about. It's supposed to be there. It's in every vertebra animal. So every animal that has a backbone, it's there. It's not necessary for life, but it sure is important for health. So a lot of people have no idea how many vital roles stomach acid plays in our bodies. And I believe that this misunderstanding is perpetuated by the powers that be, who continually insist that stomach acid is not essential and that, you know, all of your problems are because of too much stomach acid. Heartburn is too much stomach acid. I don't really think that's the issue. You know, there are millions of people around the world taking acid-suppressing drugs, and it's not really getting to the underlying causes of heartburn.
Right, because the heartburn is increasing.
Right. Heartburn is increasing as they get older, and if it were working, if that were actually fixing the problem, you wouldn't have to continually take the pill. You stop taking it, and it all comes back.
Right. Plus, it's not just, you know, the being uncomfortable from heartburn or GERD. It causes serious problems.
Right. And there are some big consequences. One of the big consequences of taking acid stopping drugs is, like what we were just talking about, the increased bacterial overgrowth. It impairs nutrient absorption. It decreases your resistance to infections, and it increases your risk of cancer and other diseases as well. So low stomach acid, like we said before, causes bacterial overgrowth in the stomach and other parts of our intestine. This bacterial overgrowth is causes us to maldigest carbohydrates, so we don't digest them properly, and we produce gas. The gas causes intra-abdominal pressure to increase, which forces food and stomach acids back up into the stomach back up into the esophagus where they burn, giving us the symptoms of heartburn and GERD. Okay? Are we all on the same page? So there are studies out there that confirm that proton pump inhibitors profoundly alter the gastrointestinal bacterial population by suppressing stomach acid. I mean, they do their job. This is one medication that's absolutely doing its job. It's stopping stomach acid. But researchers in Italy detected small bowel bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, in 50% of patients using proton pump inhibitors compared to only 6% of healthy subjects.
That's crazy.
Half of the people have this bowel overgrowth if they're taking a proton pump inhibitor.
So if you're taking an antacid, that's really significant.
Right. And remember, like we said last week, when we have this, if we pay attention to the commercials for these medications on TV, they say on them, don't take for longer than 2 weeks, don't take for longer than 4 weeks, don't take for longer than 6 weeks. We have people, I know friends of mine that have been taking these things for 20 years.
I know friends who have given it to their infants.
Right.
Because they're told, well, there's no harm and it'll just make it easier for your baby to digest food, which is completely false.
Right. That's exactly
right. Capable of digesting food.
Right. Okay, so we need to take another break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how stomach acid is important for healthy digestion. This is Wellness 101.
Have you seen her? So bad and pretty, moving with a style and ease. And I feel
any way you want it, it's the way you need it.
Everything. She
This is Wellness 101.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So today we are in the middle of part two of our series on heartburn and GERD. And we've been talking about bacterial overgrowth caused by acid-suppressing medications and over-the-counter things that people take for heartburn and GERD symptoms. When we left, we said that we were going to come back and we were going to talk about how stomach acid is important for healthy digestion. So what we have, the breakdown and absorption of nutrients, occurs at an optimum rate within a very narrow range of acid level in our stomach. If there isn't enough acid there, the normal chemical reactions that are required for us to actually absorb the nutrients becomes impaired. And over time, that actually leads us to things like anemia, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, depression. I mean, the list is long and plentiful. And so stomach acid is very key for digesting proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. So when we eat a food, our stomach secretes hydrochloric acid, and it triggers the production of pepsin. Pepsin is an enzyme that's necessary for us to digest and break down proteins. And if hydrochloric acid levels are depressed, then so too are pepsin levels. So because of that, then, our proteins don't get broken down into their amino acids, the smallest parts of our proteins, and peptides. This leads to a deficiency in very essential amino acids in our body, which really can turn us, give us problems like chronic depression, anxiety, insomnia. All these proteins are extremely important for our bodies to make hormones and heal and repair ourselves. I mean, they're just extremely important.
Right. Well, and at the same time, proteins that escape digestion by pepsin may end up in the bloodstream.
Right. And this is exactly what we've talked about before when we talk about food sensitivities. When these molecules go through and get into our bloodstream, they trip our immune system and make us think that we've got something here that shouldn't be here, and it puts our immune system on point, basically, and aggravates it and starts inflammatory reactions and can create, that's what leads to and creates food sensitivities,
right,
which drive us right into more chronic disease.
Yeah, it causes an autoimmune response or an allergic response. And I mean, this, it means that we can eat the most nutritious diet imaginable, and, you know, packed with vitamins, minerals, and other essential nutrients. But if we aren't absorbing those nutrients, we don't benefit from them.
Right. And that's what I talk to a lot of my patients. I mean, I had several just this last week talking about how, look, it's all about what you can digest and absorb and assimilate. It has no bearing on what you actually put in your mouth. It's what your stomach and your intestines can extract from that food and get into your body and then be able to deliver that to the cells. It's a lot more difficult than just eating something. It's all about absorption.
Right. And I think that's where people get frustrated, because they finally make the decision that they're going to start eating healthier. They're going to, you know, take control of their health and start doing things correctly. They can do that. But if their gut is not functioning properly, and one of the problems can be low stomach acid, then it doesn't matter at that point how nutritious the food is, because their body is not able to break it down and get the nutrients out of the food that their body needs.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what a lot of it is. I mean, you know, we talk about nutrients. I mean, when you can't absorb these nutrients, we're talking about things like iron. Ladies and gentlemen, that's extremely important. We all know how important iron is, especially you women out there that are listening. A lot of you suffered with anemia, and who would have thought that it could have been that you had low stomach acid that was impairing your ability to absorb and utilize iron? B12, vitamin B12, extremely important for neurologic health. Folate, calcium, zinc, all of these things are extremely important.
Right, and decades of research confirm that low stomach acid, whether it's caused by, you know, an antacid or on its own, reduces the absorption of nutrients, like you said, iron, B12, folate, calcium, and zinc.
Right. The research, there are just piles of it out
there.
Yes. So iron deficiency causes chronic anemia. We all are familiar with that, which means if we have anemia, we are not able to carry oxygen to our tissues. So we're basically just starving our body of what it needs to heal and repair. There's a study out there done that showed that 80% of people with chronic iron deficiency anemia were found to have below normal acid secretion in their stomach. I mean, iron deficiency anemia is well known consequence of surgical procedures where they take away the stomach. So like gastric bypass, everyone who has gastric bypass, they know that we have to monitor their iron. These people need to be taking iron. They may even need iron infusions. It can get so severe, the iron deficiency anemia. And some other researchers found that when they inhibit acid secretion by using Tagamet, which is an acid-stopping drug, it's pretty popular, resulted in a significant reduction of iron. This stuff plays havoc on our nutrients. So also studies have shown that when you add acid back to these people, it improves iron absorption in people that have achlorhydria, which is basically a fancy word for no stomach acid production. So sometimes people don't produce stomach acid and they have to add acid back into it. And when they do, our iron absorption increases. Another one is vitamin B12. We said earlier, just a second ago, that B12 is extremely important for nerve and brain function. It enters the body basically bound to animal-derived proteins. So in order to absorb it, we have to break that protein-vitamin bond, and we have to have stomach acid to do that.
Right, and this is why we did an entire show on B12, that we really get into
right.
the mechanism of how it gets into your body and why it is so important.
That's exactly right. And so there are a lot of studies that examine the negative effects of protein pump inhibitors on B12 absorption. I mean, it just destroys it. Another one is folic acid. That's an extremely popular supplement out there that people are very aware of. It keeps the cardiovascular system healthy. It prevents birth defects. And so low stomach acid interferes with folate absorption because it raises the pH in the small intestine. So if you give folate to achlorhydric patients that don't have stomach acid, along with an HCl or hydrochloric acid supplement, absorption of the vitamin increases by 54%. So research also shows that Tagamet and Zantac reduced folate absorption through because of the what am I trying to say? Because we're not able to break the bonds. And the reduction was 16%. That's a pretty significant reduction, especially if we're considering, you know, all of the birth defects that can happen if we don't have enough folate.
Right. And this is really important for women, especially who are looking to become pregnant. If you are taking antacids, and I know that we are seeing this with younger and younger patients that, you know, are having this problem and are reaching for over-the-counter antacids, this is something to really be, you know, cognizant of, because it doesn't matter if you're taking folic acid, you know, because a lot of women, when they get near childbearing age, will start taking prenatal vitamins thinking, okay, I'm going to make sure that I have enough folic acid, so, you know, my body is healthy, my baby will be healthy. But if you're taking an acid, you probably aren't absorbing it.
Right. Another one that we mentioned was calcium. We all know the importance of calcium for strong bones and teeth. It's responsible for potentially thousands of processes in our body when you really get down to the physiology of it. And stomach acid is extremely important in the absorption of the calcium. It's been known since the 60s, actually, when a group of researchers noted that patients with ulcers were barely absorbing calcium at all. They calculated about 2% absorption. And when they looked further into these subjects, they actually found that the pH in their stomach was 6.5. And remember, we've talked about what the pH level should be. It needs to be under 3, likely 2 or between 2 and 1. And it's a pH of 6.5, they have very little stomach acid. But when the researchers gave them hydrochloric acid supplements to lower their pH to 1, the calcium absorption rose 5 times. So that's just going right back into it. The more stomach acid we have, the better we're going to absorb nutrients.
Right. And side note, I know that we're not talking about this now, but the type of calcium that you use matters also.
Right.
And we're not going to talk about, get into that now, but it makes a huge difference. And so it there are two parts to it. You need to make sure you're taking the correct type of calcium and not, you know, the kind you get in the big jugs and the enormous horse pills, because you're probably not helping yourself. But then also making sure that you're not taking any acids, which make it impossible to break it down and actually absorb it.
Right. And then we also have zinc. Zinc is extremely important. I have a lot of patients that we give zinc to. We put zinc in a lot of people's IVs just because of how important zinc is for our body. It's important for keeping our cell membrane stable. It helps us form new bone, immune defense, immune function, night vision, and tissue growth. That's one that a lot of people forget about or don't realize is tissue growth. So in one study, they researched Tagamet. That's one of the big popular ones. They reduced zinc absorption by 50% by taking Tagamet. So I mean, we gotta lay off of these things if we want to absorb this stuff properly.
Right. And if you're having an issue, that's where IV nutrition, again, can really be a huge help.
That's right. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about the things that we can do to get rid of heartburn and GERD.
Yes.
You're listening to Wellness 101.
She loves the groove. She loves the love.
Is Wellness 101.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So today we are in the middle of part two of our series on heartburn and GERD. And we've been talking about bacterial overgrowth caused by acid-suppressing medications and over-the-counter things that people take for heartburn and GERD symptoms. When we left, we said that we were going to come back and we were going to talk about how stomach acid is important for healthy digestion. So what we have, the breakdown and absorption of nutrients, occurs at an optimum rate within a very narrow range of acid level in our stomach. If there isn't enough acid there, the normal chemical reactions that are required for us to actually absorb the nutrients becomes impaired. And over time, that actually leads us to things like anemia, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, depression. I mean, the list is long and plentiful. And so stomach acid is very key for digesting proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. So when we eat a food, our stomach secretes hydrochloric acid, and it triggers the production of pepsin. Pepsin is an enzyme that's necessary for us to digest and break down proteins. And if hydrochloric acid levels are depressed, then so too are pepsin levels. So because of that, then, our proteins don't get broken down into their amino acids, the smallest parts of our proteins, and peptides. This leads to a deficiency in very essential amino acids in our body, which really can turn us, give us problems like chronic depression, anxiety, insomnia. All these proteins are extremely important for our bodies to make hormones and heal and repair ourselves. I mean, they're just extremely important.
Right. Well, and at the same time, proteins that escape digestion by pepsin may end up in the bloodstream.
Right. And this is exactly what we've talked about before when we talk about food sensitivities. When these molecules go through and get into our bloodstream, they trip our immune system and make us think that we've got something here that shouldn't be here, and it puts our immune system on point, basically, and aggravates it and starts inflammatory reactions and can create, that's what leads to and creates food sensitivities,
right,
which drive us right into more chronic disease.
Yeah, it causes an autoimmune response or an allergic response. And I mean, this, it means that we can eat the most nutritious diet imaginable, and, you know, packed with vitamins, minerals, and other essential nutrients. But if we aren't absorbing those nutrients, we don't benefit from them.
Right. And that's what I talk to a lot of my patients. I mean, I had several just this last week talking about how, look, it's all about what you can digest and absorb and assimilate. It has no bearing on what you actually put in your mouth. It's what your stomach and your intestines can extract from that food and get into your body and then be able to deliver that to the cells. It's a lot more difficult than just eating something. It's all about absorption.
Right. And I think that's where people get frustrated, because they finally make the decision that they're going to start eating healthier. They're going to, you know, take control of their health and start doing things correctly. They can do that. But if their gut is not functioning properly, and one of the problems can be low stomach acid, then it doesn't matter at that point how nutritious the food is, because their body is not able to break it down and get the nutrients out of the food that their body needs.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what a lot of it is. I mean, you know, we talk about nutrients. I mean, when you can't absorb these nutrients, we're talking about things like iron. Ladies and gentlemen, that's extremely important. We all know how important iron is, especially you women out there that are listening. A lot of you suffered with anemia, and who would have thought that it could have been that you had low stomach acid that was impairing your ability to absorb and utilize iron? B12, vitamin B12, extremely important for neurologic health. Folate, calcium, zinc, all of these things are extremely important.
Right, and decades of research confirm that low stomach acid, whether it's caused by, you know, an antacid or on its own, reduces the absorption of nutrients, like you said, iron, B12, folate, calcium, and zinc.
Right. The research, there are just piles of it out
there.
Yes. So iron deficiency causes chronic anemia. We all are familiar with that, which means if we have anemia, we are not able to carry oxygen to our tissues. So we're basically just starving our body of what it needs to heal and repair. There's a study out there done that showed that 80% of people with chronic iron deficiency anemia were found to have below normal acid secretion in their stomach. I mean, iron deficiency anemia is well known consequence of surgical procedures where they take away the stomach. So like gastric bypass. Everyone who has gastric bypass, they know that we have to monitor their iron. These people need to be taking iron. They may even need iron infusions. It can get so severe, the iron deficiency anemia. And some other researchers found that when they inhibit acid secretion by using Tagamet, which is an acid-stopping drug, it's pretty popular, resulted in a significant reduction of iron. This stuff plays havoc on our nutrients. So also, studies have shown that when you add acid back to these people, it improves iron absorption in people that have achlorhydria, which is basically a fancy word for no stomach acid production. So sometimes people don't produce stomach acid and they have to add acid back into it. And when they do, our iron absorption increases. Another one is vitamin B12. We said earlier, just a second ago, that B12 is extremely important for nerve and brain function. It enters the body basically bound to animal-derived proteins. So in order to absorb it, we have to break that protein-vitamin bond, and we have to have stomach acid to do that.
Right, and this is why we did an entire show on B12, that we really get into
right.
The mechanism of how it gets into your body and why it is so important.
That's exactly right. And so there are a lot of studies that examine the negative effects of protein pump inhibitors on B12 absorption. I mean, it just destroys it. Another one is folic acid. That's an extremely popular supplement out there that people are very aware of. It keeps the cardiovascular system healthy. It prevents birth defects. And so low stomach acid interferes with folate absorption because it raises the pH in the small intestine. So if you give folate to achlorhydric patients that don't have stomach acid, along with an HCL or hydrochloric acid supplement, absorption of the vitamin increases by 54%. So research also shows that Tagamet and Zantac reduced folate absorption because we're not able to break the bonds. And the reduction was 16%. That's a pretty significant reduction especially if we're considering, you know, all of the birth defects that can happen if we don't have enough folate.
Right. And this is really important for women, especially who are looking to become pregnant. If you are taking antacids, and I know that we are seeing this with younger and younger patients that, you know, are having this problem and are reaching for over-the-counter antacids, this is something to really be, you know, cognizant of, because it doesn't matter if you're taking folic acid, you know, because a lot of women, when they get near childbearing age, will start taking prenatal vitamins thinking, okay, I'm going to make sure that I have enough folic acid so, you know, my body is healthy, my baby will be healthy. But if you're taking an antacid, you probably aren't absorbing it.
Right. Another one that we mentioned was calcium. We all know the importance of calcium for strong bones and teeth. It's responsible for potentially thousands of processes in our body when you really get down to the physiology of it. And stomach acid is extremely important in the absorption of the calcium. It's been known since the 60s, actually, when a group of researchers noted that patients with ulcers were barely absorbing calcium at all. They calculated about 2% absorption. And when they looked further into these subjects, they actually found that the pH in their stomach was 6.5. And remember, we've talked about what the pH level should be. It needs to be under 3, likely 2 or between 2 and 1. And it's a pH of 6.5, they have very little stomach acid. But when the researchers gave them hydrochloric acid supplements to lower their pH to 1, the calcium absorption rose 5 times. So that's just going right back into it. The more stomach acid we have, the better we're going to absorb nutrients.
Right. And side note, I know that we're not talking about this now, but the type of calcium that you use matters also.
Right.
And we're not going to talk about, get into that now, but it makes a huge difference. And so there are two parts to it. You need to make sure you're taking the correct type of calcium and not, you know, the kind you get in the big jugs and the enormous horse pills, because you're probably not helping yourself. But then also making sure that you're not taking any acids, which make it impossible to break it down and actually absorb it.
Right. And then we also have zinc. Zinc is extremely important. I have a lot of patients that we give zinc to. We put zinc in a lot of people's IVs just because of how important zinc is for our body. It's important for keeping our cell membrane stable. It helps us form new bone, immune defense, immune function, night vision, and tissue growth. That's one that a lot of people forget about or don't realize is tissue growth. So in one study, they researched Tagamet. That's one of the big popular ones. They reduced zinc absorption by 50% by taking Tagamet. So, I mean, we gotta lay off of these things if we want to absorb this stuff properly.
Right, and if you're having an issue, that's where IV nutrition, again, can really be a huge help.
That's right. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about the things that we can do to get rid of heartburn and GERD.
Yes.
You're listening to Wellness 101. She left the group.